pressure waves in the coolant. To make use of the newly developed heat exchanger, the Alpha plant had to move water rapidly through its many loops and baffles. This required a high-pressure pump which accounted for 150 pounds of the total system pressure, almost 10 times what was considered safe in Western reactors. With the pump so powerful, the whole engine room complex, normally very noisy at high speed, was like a boiler factory, and the pump's vibration was disturbing the performance of the monitor instruments. It was making the needles on his gauges waver, Pechukhov noted. He was right and wrong. The pressure gauges were really wavering because of the 30-pound overpressure waves pulsing through the system. The chief engineer did not recognize this for what it was. He had been on duty too many hours. Within the reactor vessel, these pressure waves were approaching the frequency at which a piece of equipment resonated. Roughly halfway down the interior surface of the vessel was a titanium fitting, part of the backup cooling system. In the event of a coolant loss, and after a successful scram, valves inside and outside the vessel would open, cooling the reactor either with a mixture of water and barium, or, as a last measure, with seawater, which could be vented in and out of the vessel, at the cost of ruining the entire reactor. This had been done once, and though it had been costly, the action of a junior engineer had prevented the loss of a Victor-class attack sub by catastrophic meltdown. Today, the inside valve was closed, along with the corresponding through-hull fitting. The valves were made of titanium because they had to function reliably after prolonged exposure to high temperature, and also because titanium was very corrosion-resistant. High-temperature water was murderously corrosive. What had not been fully considered was that the metal was also exposed to intense nuclear radiation, and this particular titanium alloy was not completely stable under extended neutron bombardment. The metal had become brittle over the years. The minute waves of hydraulic pressure were beating against the clapper in the valve. As the pump's frequency of vibration changed, it began to approach the frequency at which the clapper vibrated. This caused the clapper to snap harder and harder against its retaining ring. The metal at its edges began to crack. A Mishman at the forward end of the compartment heard it first, a low buzz coming through the bulkhead. At first, he thought it was feedback noise from the PA speaker, and he waited too long to check it. The clapper broke free and dropped out of the valve nozzle. It was not very large, only 10 centimeters in diameter and 5 millimeters thick. This type of fitting is called a butterfly valve, and the clapper looked just like a butterfly suspended and twirling in the water flow. If it had been made of stainless steel, it would have been heavy enough to fall to the bottom of the vessel. But it was made of titanium, which was both stronger than steel and very much lighter. The coolant flow moved it up towards the exhaust pipe. The outward-moving water carried the clapper into the pipe, which had a 15-centimeter inside diameter. The pipe was made of stainless steel, 2-meter sections welded together for easy replacement in the cramped quarters. The clapper was borne along rapidly towards the heat exchanger. Here, the pipe took a 45-degree downward turn, and the clapper jammed momentarily. This blocked half the pipe's channel, and before the surge of pressure could dislodge the clapper, too many things happened. The moving water had its own momentum. On being blocked, it generated a back pressure wave within the pipe. Total pressure jumped momentarily to 3,400 pounds. This caused the pipe to flex a few millimeters. The increased pressure, lateral displacement of a weld joint, and cumulative effects of years of high-temperature erosion of the steel damaged the joint. A hole the size of a pencil point opened. The escaping water flashed instantly into steam, setting off alarms in the reactor compartment and neighboring spaces. It ate at the remainder of the weld, rapidly expanding the failure until reactor coolant was erupting as though from a horizontal fountain. One jet of steam demolished the adjacent reactor control wiring conduits. What had just begun was a catastrophic loss of coolant accident. The reactor was fully depressurized within 3 seconds. Its many gallons of coolant exploded into steam, seeking release into the surrounding compartment. A dozen alarms sounded at once on the master control board, and in the blink of an eye, Vladimir Pechukhov faced his ultimate nightmare. The engineer's automatic trained reaction was to jam his finger on the scram switch, but the steam in the reactor vessel had disabled the rod control system, and there wasn't time to solve the problem. In an instant, Pechukakov knew that his ship was doomed. Next, he opened the emergency coolant controls, admitting seawater into the reactor vessel. This automatically set off alarms throughout the hull. In the control room forward, the captain grasped the nature of the emergency at once. The Politovsky was running at 150 meters. He had to get her to the surface immediately, and he shouted orders to blow all ballast and made full rise on the diving planes. The reactor emergency was regulated by physical laws. With no reactor coolant to absorb the heat of the uranium rods, the nuclear reaction actually stopped. There was no water to attenuate the neutron flux. This was no solution, however, since the residual decay heat was sufficient to melt everything in the compartment. The cold water admitted into the vessel drew off the heat, but also slowed down too many neutrons, keeping them in the reactor core. This caused a runaway reaction that generated even more heat, more than any amount of coolant could control. What had started as a loss of coolant accident became something worse, a cold water accident. It was now only a matter of minutes before the entire core melted, and the Politovsky had that long to get to the surface. Pechukakov stayed at his post in the engine room, doing what he could. His own life, he knew, was almost certainly lost. He had to give his captain time to surface the boat. There was a drill for this sort of emergency, and he barked orders to implement it. It only made things worse. His duty electrician moved along the electrical control panels, switching from main power to emergency, since residual steam power in the turbo alternators would die in a few more seconds. In a moment, the submarine's power completely depended on standby batteries. In the control room, power was lost to the electrically controlled trim tabs on the trailing edge of the diving planes, which automatically switched back to electrohydraulic control. This powered not just the small trim tabs, but the diving planes as well. The control assemblies moved instantly to a 15-degree up angle, and she was still moving at 39 knots. With all her ballast tanks now blasted free of water by compressed air, the submarine was very light, and she rose like a climbing aircraft. In seconds, the astonished control room crew felt their boat rise to an up angle that was 45 degrees and getting worse. A moment later, they were too busy trying to stand to come to grips with the problem. Now, the Alpha was climbing almost vertically at 30 miles per hour. Every man and unsecured item aboard fell sternward. In the motor control room aft, a crewman crashed against the main electrical switchboard, short-circuiting it with his body, and all power aboard was lost. A cook who had been inventorying survival gear in the torpedo room forward struggled into the escape trunk as he fought his way into an exposure suit. Even with only a year's experience, he was quick to understand the meaning of the hooting alarms and unprecedented actions of his boat. He yanked the hatch shut and began to work the escape controls, as he had been taught in submarine school. The Politovsky soared through the surface of the Atlantic like a broaching whale, coming three-quarters of her length out of the water before crashing back. The USS Pogey.
Khan, sonar.
Khan, aye. Captain speaking.
Skipper, you better hear this. Something just went crazy on bait two,
Pogey's chief reported. Wood was in the sonar room in seconds, putting on earphones plugged into a tape recorder, which had a 2-minute offset. Commander Wood heard a whooshing sound. The engine noises stopped. A few seconds later, there was an explosion of compressed air, and a staccato of hull-popping noises as a submarine changed depth rapidly.
"What's going on?"
Wood asked quickly. The ES Politovsky. In the Politovsky's reactor, the runaway fission reaction had virtually annihilated both the incoming seawater and the uranium fuel rods. Their debris settled on the after wall of the reactor vessel. In a minute, there was a meter-wide puddle of radioactive slag, enough to form its own critical mass. The reaction continued unabated, this time directly attacking the tough stainless steel of the vessel. Nothing man-made could long withstand 5,000 degrees of direct heat. In 10 seconds, the vessel wall failed. The uranium mass dropped free against the aft bulkhead. Pechukhovkov knew he was dead. He saw the paint on the forward bulkhead turn black, and his last impression was of a dark mass surrounded with a blue glow. The engineer's body vaporized an instant later, and the mass of slag dropped to the next bulkhead aft. Forward, the submarine's nearly vertical angle in the water eased. The high-pressure air in the ballast tanks spilled out of the bottom floods, and the tanks filled with water, dropping the angle of the boat and submerging her. In the forward part of the submarine, men were screaming. The captain struggled to his feet, ignoring his broken leg, trying to get control, to get his men organized and out of the submarine before it was too late. But the luck of Evgeny Sigismondovich Politovsky would plague his namesake one last time. Only one man escaped. The cook opened the escape trunk hatch and got out. Following what he had learned during the drill, he began to seal the hatch so that men behind him could use it. But a wave slapped him off the hull as the sub slid backwards. In the engine room, the changing angle dropped the melted core to the deck. The hot mass attacked the steel deck first, burning through that, then the titanium of the hull. 5 seconds later, the engine room was vented to the sea. The Politovsky's largest compartment filled rapidly with water. This destroyed what little reserve buoyancy the ship had, and the acute down angle returned. The Alpha began her last dive. The stern dropped, just as the captain began to get his control room crew to react to orders again. His head struck an instrument console. What slim hopes his crew had died with him. The Politovsky was falling backwards, her propeller windmilling the wrong way as she slid to the bottom of the sea. The Pogie. "Skipper, I was on the chopper back in 69, the Pogie's chief said, referring to a horrifying accident on a diesel-powered submarine. "That's what it sounds like," his captain said. He was now listening to direct sonar input. There was no mistaking it. The submarine was flooding. They had heard the ballast tanks refill. This could only mean interior compartments were filling with water. If they had been closer, they might have heard the screams of men in that doomed hull. Wood was just as happy he couldn't. The continuing rush of water was dreadful enough. Men were dying. Russians, his enemy, but men not unlike himself. And there was not a thing that could be done about it. Bait One, he saw, was proceeding, unmindful of what had happened to her trailing sister. The E.S. Politovsky. It took 9 minutes for the Politovsky to fall the 2,000 feet to the ocean floor. She impacted savagely on the hard sand bottom at the edge of the continental shelf. It was a tribute to her builders that her interior bulkheads held. All the compartments from the reactor room aft were flooded, and half the crew killed in them. But the forward compartments were dry. Even this was more curse than blessing. With the aft air storage banks unusable, and only emergency battery power to run the complex environmental control systems, the 40 men had only a limited supply of air. They were spared a rapid death from the crushing North Atlantic, only to face a slower one from asphyxiation. The Ninth Day. Saturday, 11th December. The Pentagon. A female yeoman first class held the door open for Tyler. He walked in to find General Harris standing alone over the large chart table, pondering the placement of tiny ship models.
"You must be Skip Tyler," Harris looked up.
"Yes, sir."
Tyler was standing as rigidly at attention as his prosthetic leg allowed. Harris came over quickly to shake hands.
"Greer says you used to play ball."
"Yes, General. I played right tackle at Annapolis. Those were good years."
Tyler smiled, flexing his fingers. Harris looked like an iron pumper.
"Okay, if you used to play ball, you can call me Ed."
Harris poked him in the chest.
"Your number was 78, and you made All-American, right?"
"Second string, sir. Nice to know somebody remembers. I was temporary duty at the academy for a few months back then, and I caught a couple of games. I never forget a good offensive lineman. I made all-conference at Montana, long time ago. What happened to the leg?
Drunk driver clipped me. I was the lucky one. The drunk didn't make it.
Serves the bastard right.
Tyler nodded agreement, but remembered that the drunken shipfitter had his own wife and family, according to the police.
Where is everybody?
The chiefs are at their normal, well, normal for a weekday, not a Saturday, intelligence briefing. They ought to be down in a few minutes.
So you're teaching engineering at Annapolis now, eh?
Yes, sir. I got a doctorate in that along the way.
Name's Ed, Skip.
And this morning, you're going to tell us how we can hold on to that maverick Russian sub?
Yes, sir. Ed.
Tell me about it. But let's get some coffee first.
The two men went to a table in the corner with coffee and donuts. Harris listened to the younger man for 5 minutes, sipping his coffee and devouring a couple of jam donuts. It took a lot of food to support his frame.
Son of a gun, the J3 observed when Tyler finished.
He walked over to the chart.
That's interesting. Your idea depends a lot on sleight of hand. We'd have to keep them away from where we're pulling this off.
About here, you say?
He tapped the chart.
Yes, General. The thing is, the way they seem to be operating, we can do this to seaward of them.
And do a double shuffle. I like it.
Yeah, I like it.
But Dan Foster won't like losing one of our own boats.
I'd say it's worth the trade.
So would I, Harris agreed. But they're not my boats. After we do this, where do we hide her?
If we get her.
General, there are some nice places right here on the Chesapeake Bay. There's a deep spot on the York River and another on the Patuxent, both owned by the Navy, both marked Keep Out on the charts.
Nice thing about subs? They're supposed to be invisible.
You just find a deep enough spot and flood your tanks.
That's temporary, of course. For a more permanent spot, maybe truck or quadruline in the Pacific? Nice and far from any place.
And the Soviets would never notice the presence of a subtender and 300 submarine technicians there all of a sudden?
Besides, those islands don't really belong to us anymore, remember?
Tyler hadn't expected this man to be a dummy.
So what if they do find out in a few months? What will they do? Announce it to the whole world?
I don't think so.
By that time, we'll have all the information we want. We can always produce the defecting officers in a nice news conference.
How would that look for them?
Anyway, it figures that after we've had her for a while, we'll break her up. The reactor will go to Idaho for tests. The missiles and warheads will get taken off. The electronics gear will be taken to California for testing, and the CIA, NSA, and Navy will have gunfights over the crypto gear. The stripped hulk will be taken to a nice deep spot and scuttled. No evidence. We don't have to keep this a secret forever. Just for a few months.
Harris set his cup down. You'll have to forgive me for playing devil's advocate. I see you've thought this out.
Fine. I think it's worth a hard look. It means coordinating a lot of hardware, but it doesn't really interfere with what we're already doing.
Okay. You have my vote.
The Joint Chiefs arrived 3 minutes later. Tyler had never seen so many stars in one room.
You wanted to see all of us, Eddie? Hilton asked.
Yes, General, this is Dr. Skip Tyler.
Admiral Foster came over first to take his hand.
You got us that performance data on Red October that we were just briefed on. Good work, Commander.
Dr. Tyler thinks we should hold on to her if we get her, Harris said deadpan.
The President won't let us.
Gentlemen, what if I told you that there was a way to send the crewmen home without them knowing that we have her? That's the issue, right? We have to send the crewmen back to Mother Russia. I say there's a way to do that, and the remaining question is where to hide her.
We're listening, Hilton said suspiciously.
Well, sir, we'll have to move quickly to get everything in place. We'll need Avalon from the West Coast. Mystic is already aboard the Pigeon in Charleston. We need both of them, and we need an old boomer of our own that we can afford to do without. That's the hardware. The real trick, however, is the timing. And we have to find her. That may be the hardest part.
Maybe not, Foster said. Admiral Gallery reported this morning that Dallas may be on to her. Her report dovetails nicely with your engineering model. We'll know more in a few days.
Go on.
Tyler explained. It took 10 minutes since he had to answer questions and use the chart to diagram time and space constraints. When he was finished,
General Barnes was at the phone, calling the commander of the Military Airlift Command. Foster left the room to call Norfolk, and Hilton was on his way to the White House. The Red October. Except for those on watch, every officer was in the wardroom. Several pots of tea were on the table, all untouched, and again, the door was locked.
"Comrades," Petrov reported, "the second set of badges was contaminated, worse than the first."
Romius noted that Petrov was rattled. It wasn't the first set of badges, or the second. It was the third and fourth since sailing. He had chosen his ship's doctor well.
"Bad badges," Melikin growled. "Some bastard of a trickster in Severomorsk, or perhaps an imperialist spy playing a typical enemy trick on us. When they catch the son of a bitch, I will shoot him myself, whoever he is. This sort of thing is treasonous."
"Regulations require that I report this," Petrov noted, "even though the instruments show safe levels."
"Your adherence to the rules is noted, comrade doctor. You have acted correctly," Romius said. "And now regulations stipulate that we make yet another check. Melikin, I want you and Borodin to do it personally. First check the radiation instruments themselves. If they are working properly, we will be certain that the badges are defective, or have been tampered with. If so, my report on this incident would demand someone's head."
It was not unknown for drunken shipyard workers to be sent to the gulag.
"Comrades, in my opinion, there is nothing at all to concern us. If there were a leak, Comrade Melikin would have discovered it days ago. We all have work to do."
They were all back in the wardroom half an hour later. Passing crewmen noticed this, and already the whispering started.
"Comrades," Melikin announced, "we have a major problem."
The officers, especially the younger ones, looked a little pale. On the table was a Geiger counter, stripped into a score of small parts. Next to it was a radiation detector taken off the reactor room bulkhead, its inspection cover removed.
"Sabotage," Melikin hissed.
It was a word fearsome enough to make any Soviet citizen shudder. The room went deathly still, and Romius noted that Sviadov was holding his face under rigid control.
"Comrades, mechanically speaking, these instruments are quite simple. As you know, this counter has 10 different settings. We can choose from 10 sensitivity ranges, using the same instrument to detect a minor leak or to quantify a major one. We do that by dialing this selector, which engages one of 10 electrical resistors of increasing value. A child could design this, or maintain and repair it." The chief engineer tapped the underside of the selector dial. "In this case, the proper resistors have been clipped off, and new ones soldered on. Settings 1 to 8 have the same impedance value, and all our counters were inspected by the same dockyard technician 3 days before we sailed. Here is the inspection sheet."
Melikin tossed it on the table contemptuously.
"Either he or another spy sabotaged this and all the other counters I've looked at. It would have taken a skilled man no more than an hour. In the case of this instrument..."
The engineer turned the fixed detector over.
"You see that the electrical parts have been disconnected, except for the test circuit, which was rewired. Borodin and I removed this from the forward bulkhead. This is skilled work. Whoever did this is no amateur. I believe that an imperialist agent has sabotaged our ship. First he disabled our radiation monitor instruments. Then he probably arranged a low-level leak in our hop piping. It would appear, comrades, that Comrade Petrov was correct. We may have a leak. My apologies, doctor."
Petrov nodded jerkily. Compliments like this, he could easily forgo.
"Total exposure, Comrade Petrov?" Romius asked.
"The greatest is for the engine men, of course. The maximum is 50 rads for Comrades Melikin and Sviadov. The other engine crewmen run from 20 to 45 rads, and the cumulative exposure drops rapidly as one moves forward. The torpedo men have only 5 rads or so, mostly less. The officers exclusive of engineers run from 10 to 25.
Petrov paused, telling himself to be more positive.
"Comrades, these are not lethal doses. In fact, one can tolerate a dose of up to 100 rads. without any near-term physiological effects, and one can survive several hundred. We do face a serious problem here, but it is not yet a life-threatening emergency.
Melechin? The captain asked.
It is my engine plant and my responsibility. We do not yet know that we have a leak. The badges could still be defective or sabotaged. This could all be a vicious psychological trick played on us by the main enemy to damage our morale. Borodin will assist me. We will personally repair these and conduct a thorough inspection of all the reactor systems. I am too old to have children. For the moment, I suggest that we deactivate the reactor and proceed on battery. The inspection will take us 4 hours at most. I also recommend that we reduce reactor watches to 2 hours. Agreed, Captain.
Certainly, comrade. I know that there is nothing you cannot repair.
Excuse me, comrade captain, Ivanov spoke up. Should we report this to fleet headquarters?
Our orders are not to break radio silence, Ramius said.
If the Imperialists were able to sabotage our instruments, what if they knew our orders beforehand and are attempting to make us use the radio so they can locate us? Borodin asked.
A possibility, Ramius replied. First, we will determine if we have a problem, then its severity. Comrades, we have a fine crew and the best officers in the fleet. We will see to our own problems, conquer them, and continue our mission. We all have a date in Cuba that I intend to meet. To hell with imperialist plots!
Well said, Melechin concurred.
Comrades, we will keep this secret. There is no reason to excite the crew over what may be nothing, and at most is something we can handle on our own. Ramius ended the meeting.
Petrov was less sure, and Sviadov was trying very hard not to shake. He had a sweetheart at home, and wanted one day to have children. The young lieutenant had been painstakingly trained to understand everything that went on in the reactor systems, and to know what to do if things went awry. And it was some consolation to know that most of the solutions to reactor problems to be found in the book had been written by some of the men in this room. Even so, something that could neither be seen nor felt was invading his body, and no rational person would be happy with that. The meeting adjourned. Melechin and Borodin went aft to the engineering stores. A Mishman electrician came with them to get the proper parts. He noted that they were reading from the maintenance manual for a radiation detector. When he went off duty an hour later, the whole crew knew that the reactor had been shut down yet again. The electrician conferred with his bunkmate, a missile maintenance technician. Together they discussed the reason for working on a half-dozen Geiger counters and other instruments, and their conclusion was an obvious one. The submarine's bosun overheard the discussion and pondered the conclusion himself. He had been on nuclear submarines for 10 years. Despite this, he was not an educated man and regarded any activity in the reactor spaces as something to the left of witchcraft. It worked the ship. How, he did not know, though he was certain that there was something unholy about it. Now he began to wonder if the devils he never saw inside that steel drum were coming loose. Within 2 hours, the entire crew knew that something was wrong, and that their officers had not yet figured out a way to deal with it. The cooks bringing food forward from the galley to the crew spaces were seen to linger in the bow as long as they could. Men standing watch in the control room shifted on their feet more than usual, Ramius noted, hurrying forward at the change of watch. The USS New Jersey. It took some getting used to, Commodore Zachary Eaton reflected. When his flagship was built, he was sailing boats in a bathtub. Back then, the Russians were allies, but allies of convenience, who shared a common enemy instead of a common goal. Like the Chinese today, he judged, the enemy then had been the Germans and the Japanese. In his 26-year career, he had been to both countries many times, and his first command, a destroyer, had been homeported at Yokosuka. It was a strange world. There were several nice things about his flagship. Big as she was, her movement on the 10-foot seas was just enough to remind him that he was at sea, not at a desk. Visibility was about 10 miles, And somewhere out there, about 800 miles away, was the Russian fleet. His battleship was going to meet them, just like in the old days, as if the aircraft carrier had never come along. The destroyers Karen and Stump were in sight, 5 miles off either bow. Further forward, the cruisers Biddle and Wainwright were doing radar picket duty. The surface action group was marking time instead of proceeding forward as he would have preferred. Off the New Jersey coast, the helicopter assault ship Tarawa and 2 frigates were racing to join up, bringing 10 AV-8B Harrier attack fighters and 14 ASW helicopters to supplement his air strength. This was useful, but not of critical concern to Eaton. The Saratoga's air wing was now operating out of Maine, along with a goodly collection of Air Force birds working hard to learn the maritime strike business. HMS Invincible was 200 miles to his east, conducting aggressive ASW patrols, and 800 miles east of that force was the Kennedy, hiding under a weather front off the Azores. It slightly irked the Commodore that the Brits were helping out. Since when did the U.S. Navy need help defending the American coast? Not that they didn't owe us the favor, though. The Russians had split into 3 groups, with the carrier Kiev easternmost to face the Kennedy's battle group. His expected responsibility was the Moskva group, with the Invincible handling the Kirovs. Data on all 3 was being fed to him continuously and digested by his operations staff down in Flagplot. What were the Soviets up to? He wondered. He knew the story that they were searching for a lost sub, but Eaton believed that as much as if they'd explained that they had a bridge they wanted to sell. Probably, he thought, they want to demonstrate that they can trail their coats down our coast whenever they want, to show that they have a seagoing fleet and to establish a precedent for doing this again. Eaton did not like that. He did not much care for his assigned mission either. He had 2 tasks that were not fully compatible. Keeping an eye on their submarine activity would be difficult enough. The Saratoga's Vikings were not working his area, despite his request, and most of the Orions were working farther out, closer to the Invincible. His own ASW assets were barely adequate for local defense, much less active sub-hunting. The Tarawa would change that, but also change his screening requirements. His other mission was to establish and maintain sensor contact with the Moskva group, and to report at once any unusual activity to Sinklant FLT, the commander-in-chief of the Atlantic Fleet. This made sense. Sort of. If their surface ships did anything untoward, Eaton had the means to deal with them. It was being decided now how closely he should shadow them. The problem was whether he should be nearby or far away. Near meant 20 miles, gun range. The Moskva had 10 escorts, none of which could possibly survive more than 2 of his 16-inch projectiles. At 20 miles, he had the choice of using full-sized or sub-caliber rounds, the latter guided to their targets by a laser designator installed atop the main director tower. Tests the previous year had determined that he could maintain a steady firing rate of 1 round every 20 seconds, with the laser shifting fire from 1 target to another until there were no more. But this would expose the New Jersey and her escorts to torpedo and missile fire from the Russian ships. Backing farther off, he could still fire sabot rounds from 50 miles, and they could be directed to the target by a laser designator aboard the battle wagon's helicopter. This would expose the chopper to surface-to-air missile fire and to Soviet helicopters suspected of having air-to-air missile capability. To help out with this, the Tarawa was bringing a pair of Apache attack helicopters, which carried lasers, air-to-air missiles, and their own air-to-surface missiles. They were anti-tank weapons expected to work well against small warships. His ships would be exposed to missile fire, but he didn't fear for his flagship. Unless the Russians were carrying nuclear warheads, their anti-ship missiles would not be able to damage his ship gravely. The New Jersey had upwards of 1 foot of Class B armor plate. They would, however, play hell with his radar and communications gear, and worse, they would be lethal to his thin-hulled escorts. His ships carried their own anti-ship missiles, harpoons and tomahawks, though not as many as he would have liked. And what about a Russian sub hunting them? Eaton had been told of none.
but you never knew where one might be hiding. Oh, well. He couldn't worry about everything. A submarine could sink the New Jersey, but she would have to work at it. If the Russians were really up to something nasty, they'd get the first shot, but Eaton would have enough warning to launch his own missiles and get off a few rounds of gunfire while calling for air support, none of which would happen, he was sure. He decided that the Russians were on some sort of fishing expedition. His job was to show them that the fish in these waters were dangerous. Naval Air Station, North Island, California. The oversized tractor-trailer crept at 2 miles per hour into the cargo bay of the C-5A Galaxy transport under the watchful eye of the aircraft's loadmaster, 2 flight officers, and 6 naval officers. Oddly, only the latter, none of whom wore aviator's wings, were fully versed in the procedure. The vehicle's center of gravity was precisely marked, and they watched the mark approach a particular number engraved on the cargo bay floor. The work had to be done exactly. Any mistake could fatally impair the aircraft's trim and imperil the lives of the flight crew and passengers.
"Okay, freeze it right there," the senior officer called.
The driver was only too glad to stop. He left the keys in the ignition, set all the brakes, and put the truck in gear before getting out. Someone else would drive it out of the aircraft on the other side of the country. The loadmaster and 6 airmen immediately went to work, snaking steel cables to eye bolts on the truck and trailer to secure the heavy load. Shifting cargo was something else an aircraft rarely survived, and the C-5A did not have ejection seats. The loadmaster saw to it that his ground crewmen were properly at work before walking over to the pilot. He was a 25-year sergeant who loved the C-5s despite their blemished history.
"Captain, what the hell is this thing?"
"It's called a DSRV, Sarge. Deep Submergence Rescue Vehicle."
"Says Avalon on the back, sir," the sergeant pointed out.
"Yeah, so it has a name. It's sort of a lifeboat for submarines. Goes down to get the crew out if something screws up."
"Oh,"
the sergeant considered that. He'd flown tanks, helicopters, general cargo, once a whole battalion of troops on his, he thought of the aircraft as his, Galaxy before. This was the first time he'd ever flown a ship. If it had a name, he reasoned, it was a ship. Damn, the Galaxy could do anything.
"Where are we taking it, sir?"
"Norfolk Naval Air Station. And I've never been there either." The pilot watched the securing process closely. Already 12 cables were attached. When 12 more were in place, they'd put tension on the cables to prevent the minutest shift.
"We figure a trip of 5 hours, 40 minutes, all on internal fuel. We got the jet stream on our side today. Weather's supposed to be okay until we hit the coast. We lay over for a day, then come back Monday morning."
"Your boys work pretty fast," said the senior naval officer, Lieutenant Ames, coming over.
"Yes, Lieutenant, another 20 minutes. The pilot checked his watch. "We ought to be taking off on the hour."
"No hurry, Captain. If this thing shifts in flight, I guess it would ruin our whole day. Where do I send my people?"
"Upper deck forward. There's room for 15 or so just after the flight deck."
Lieutenant Ames knew this, but he didn't say so. He'd flown with his DSRV across the Atlantic several times and across the Pacific once, every time on a different C-5.
"May I ask what the big deal is?" the pilot inquired.
"I don't know," Ames said. "They want me and my baby in Norfolk."
"You really take this little bitty thing underwater, sir?" the loadmaster asked.
"That's what they pay me for. I've had her down to 4,800 feet, almost a mile."
Ames regarded his vessel with affection.
"A mile underwater, sir? Jesus, pardon me, sir, but, I mean, isn't that a little hairy? The water pressure, I mean?"
"Not really. I've been down to 20,000 aboard Trieste. It's really pretty interesting down there. You see all kinds of strange fish."
Though a fully qualified submariner, Ames' first love was research. He had a degree in oceanography and had commanded or served in all of the Navy's deep submergence vehicles except the nuclear-powered NR-1. Of course, the water pressure would do bad things to you if anything went wrong, but it would be so fast you'd never know it. If you fellows want a check ride, I could probably arrange it. It's a different world down there.
"That's okay, sir." The sergeant went back to swearing at his men.
"You weren't serious," the pilot observed.
"Why not? It's no big deal. We take civilians down all the time, and believe me, it's a lot less hairy than riding this damn white whale during a mid-air refueling.
Uh-huh, the pilot noted dubiously. He'd done hundreds of those. It was entirely routine, and he was surprised that anyone would find it dangerous. You had to be careful, of course, but hell, you had to be careful driving every morning. He was sure that an accident on this pocket submarine wouldn't leave enough of a man to make a decent meal for a shrimp. Takes all kinds, he decided. You don't go to sea by yourself in that, do you?
No. Ordinarily, we work off a submarine rescue ship, Pigeon or Ortolan. We can also operate off a regular submarine. That gadget you see there in the trailer is our mating collar. We can nest on the back of a sub at the after escape trunk, and the sub takes us where we need to go.
Does this have to do with the flap on the East Coast?
That's a good bet, but nobody said anything official to us. The papers say the Russians have lost a sub. If so, we might have to go down to look at her. Maybe rescue any survivors. We can take off 20 or 25 men at a time, and our mating collar is designed to fit Russian subs as well as our own.
Same size?
Close enough, Ames cocked an eyebrow. We plan for all kinds of contingencies.
Interesting.
The North Atlantic. The YAK-36 Forger had left the Kiev half an hour before, guided first by gyrocompass and now by the ESM pod on the fighter's stubby rudder fin. Senior Lieutenant Viktor Shavrov's mission was not an easy one. He was to approach the American E-3A Sentry radar surveillance aircraft, one of which had been shadowing his fleet for 3 days now. The AWACS, Airborne Warning and Control System, aircraft, had been careful to circle well beyond SAM range, but had stayed close enough to maintain constant coverage of the Soviet fleet, reporting every maneuver and radio transmission to their command base. It was like having a burglar watching one's apartment and being unable to do anything about it. Shavrov's mission was to do something about it. He couldn't shoot, of course. His orders from Admiral Strelbo in the Kirov had been explicit about that. But he was carrying a pair of Atoll heat-seeking missiles, which he could be sure to show the imperialists. He and his admiral expected that this would teach them a lesson. The Soviet Navy did not like having imperialist snoopers about, and accidents had been known to happen. It was a mission worthy of the effort it took. This effort was considerable. To avoid detection by the airborne radar, Shavrov had to fly as low and slow as his fighter could operate, a bare 20 meters above the rough Atlantic. This way, he would get lost in the sea return. His speed was 200 knots. This made for excellent fuel economy, though his mission was at the ragged edge of his fuel load. It also made for very rough flying, as his fighter bounced through the roiled air at the wavetops. There was a low-hanging mist that cut visibility to a few kilometers. So much the better, he thought. The nature of the mission had chosen him, rather than the other way around. He was one of the few Soviet pilots experienced in low-level flying. Shavrov had not become a sailor pilot by himself. He'd started flying attack helicopters for frontal aviation in Afghanistan, graduating to fixed-wing aircraft after a year's bloody apprenticeship. Shavrov was an expert in nap-of-the-earth flying, having learned it by necessity, hunting the bandits and counter-revolutionaries that hid in the towering mountains like hydrophobic rats. This skill had made him attractive to the fleet, which had transferred him to sea duty without his having had much say in the matter. After a few months, he had no complaints, his perks and extra pay being more attractive than his former frontal aviation base on the Chinese border. Being one of the few hundred carrier-qualified Soviet airmen had softened the blow of missing his chance to fly the new MiG-27, though with luck, if the new full-sized carrier were ever finished, he'd have the chance to fly the naval version of that wonderful bird. Shavrov could wait for that, and with a few successful missions like this one, he might have his squadron command. He stopped daydreaming. The mission was too demanding for that. This was real flying. He'd never flown against Americans, only against the weapons they gave to the Afghan bandits. He had lost friends to those weapons, some of whom had survived their crashes only to be done to death by the Afghan savages in ways that would have made even a German puke. It would be good to teach the imperialists a lesson personally.
the radar signal was growing stronger. Beneath his ejection seat, a tape recorder was making a continuous record of the signal characteristics of the American aircraft, so that the scientific people would be able to devise a means of jamming and foiling the vaunted American flying eye. The aircraft was only a converted 707, a glorified passenger plane, hardly a worthy opponent for a crack fighter pilot. Shevrov checked his chart. He'd have to find it soon. Next, he checked his fuel. He'd dropped his last external tank a few minutes earlier, and all he had now was his internal fuel. The turbofan was guzzling fuel, something he had to keep an eye on. He planned to have only 5 or 10 minutes of fuel left when he returned to his ship. This did not trouble him. He already had over 100 carrier landings. There! His hawk's eyes caught the glint of sun off metal at 1 o'clock high. Shevrov eased back on his stick and increased power gently, bringing his Forger into a climb. A minute later, he was at 2,000 meters. He could see the Sentry now, its blue paint blending neatly into the darkening sky. He was coming up beneath its tail, and with luck, the empennage would shield him from the rotating radar antenna. Perfect. He'd blaze by her a few times, letting the flight crew see his atolls and... It took Shevrov a moment to realize he had a wingman. 2 wingmen. 50 meters to his left and right, a pair of American F-15 Eagle fighters. The visored face of one pilot was staring at him. Yak-106, please acknowledge. The voice on his SSB, single sideband, radio circuit spoke flawless Russian. Shevrov did not acknowledge. They had read the number off his engine intake housing before he had known they were there. 106, this is the Sentry aircraft. You are now approaching. Please identify yourself and your intentions. We get a little anxious when a stray fighter comes our way, so we've had 3 following you for the past 100 kilometers. 3? Shevrov turned his head around. A third Eagle with 4 Sparrow missiles was hanging 50 meters from his tail. His 6. Our men compliment you on your ability to fly low and slow, 106. Lieutenant Shevrov was shaking with rage as he passed 4,000 meters, still 8,000 from the American AWACS. He had checked his 6 every 30 seconds on the way in. The Americans must have been riding back there, hidden in the mist, and vectored in on him by instructions from the Sentry. He swore to himself and held course. He'd teach that AWACS a lesson. Break off, 106. It was a cool voice, without emotion, except perhaps a trace of irony. 106, if you do not break off, we will consider your mission to be hostile. Think about it, 106. You are beyond radar coverage of your own ships, and you are not yet within missile range of us. Shevrov looked to his right. The Eagle was breaking off. So was the one on the left. Was it a gesture? Taking the heat off of him? And expecting some courtesy in return? Or were they clearing the way for the one behind him? He checked. Still there. To shoot? There was no telling what these imperialist criminals would do. He was at least a minute from the fringe of their missile range. Shevrov was anything but a coward. Neither was he a fool. He moved his stick, curving his fighter a few degrees to the right. Thank you, 106, the voice acknowledged. You see... We have some trainee operators aboard, 2 of them are women, and we don't want them to get rattled their first time out. Suddenly, it was too much. Shevrov thumbed the radio switch on his stick. Shall I tell you what you can do with your women, Yankee? You are Nekulturny, 106, the voice replied softly. Perhaps the long overwater flight has made you nervous. You must be about at the limit of your internal fuel. Bastard of a day to fly. What with all these crazy shifting winds? Do you need a position check? Over. Negative, Yankee! Course back to Kiev is 185 true. Have to be careful using a magnetic compass this far north, you know. Distance to Kiev is 318.6 kilometers. Warning, there is a rapidly moving cold front coming in from the southwest. That's going to make flying a little rough in a few hours. Do you require an escort back to the Kiev? Pig! Shevrov swore to himself. He switched his radio off, cursing himself for his lack of discipline. He had allowed the Americans to wound his pride. Like most fighter pilots, he had a surfeit of that.
106, we did not copy your last transmission. Two of my Eagles are heading that way. They will form up on you and see that you get home safely. Have a happy day, comrade. Century November, out. The American lieutenant turned to his colonel. He couldn't keep a straight face any longer. God, I thought I'd strangle talking like that. He sipped some Coke from a plastic cup. He really thought he'd sneak up on us. In case you didn't notice, he did get within a mile of atoll range, and we don't have authorization to shoot at him until he flips one at us, which might wreck our day, the colonel grumped. Nice job twisting his tail, lieutenant. A pleasure, colonel. The operator looked at his screen. Well, he's heading back to Mama, with Cobras 3 and 4 on his 6. He's going to be one unhappy Ruski when he gets home. If he gets home. Even with those drop tanks, he must be near his range limit. He thought for a moment. Colonel, if they do this again, how about we offer to take the guy home with us? Get a forger? For what? I suppose the Navy would like to have one to play with. They don't get much of Ivan's hardware, but the forger's a piece of junk. Shavrov was tempted to firewall his engine, but restrained himself. He'd already shown enough personal weakness for one day. Besides, his Yak could only break Mach 1 in a dive. Those Eagles could do it straight up, and they had plenty of fuel. He saw that they both carried fast-pack conformal fuel cells. They could cross whole oceans with those. Damn the Americans and their arrogance. Damn his own intelligence officer for telling him he could sneak up on the sentry. Let the air-to-air armed backfires go after them. They could handle that damned overbred passenger bus. Could get it to faster than its fighter guardians could react. The Americans, he saw, were not lying about the weather front. A line of cold-weather squalls racing northeast was just on the horizon as he approached the Kiev. The Eagles backed off as he approached the formation. One American pilot pulled alongside briefly to wave goodbye. His head bobbed at Shavrov's return gesture. The Eagles paired up and turned back north. 5 minutes later, he was aboard the Kiev, still pale with rage. As soon as the wheels were chocked, he jumped to the carrier deck, stomping off to see his squadron commander. The Kremlin. The city of Moscow was justly famous for its subway system. For a pittance, people could ride nearly anywhere they wanted on a modern, safe, garishly decorated electric railway system. In case of war, the underground tunnels could serve as a bomb shelter for the citizens of Moscow. The secondary use was the result of the efforts of Nikita Khrushchev, who, when construction was begun in the mid-30s, had suggested to Stalin that the system be driven deep. Stalin had approved. The shelter consideration had been decades ahead of its time. Nuclear fission had then only been a theory. Fusion, hardly thought of at all. On a spur of the line running from Sverdlov Square to the old airport, which ran near the Kremlin, workers bored a tunnel that was later closed off with a 10-meter-thick steel and concrete plug. The 100-meter-long space was connected to the Kremlin by a pair of elevator shafts, and over time it had been converted to an emergency command center from which the Politburo could control the entire Soviet empire. The tunnel was also a convenient means of going unseen from the city to a small airport from which Politburo members would be flown to their ultimate redoubt, beneath the granite monolith at Zhiguli. Neither command post was a secret to the West. Both had existed far too long for that, but the KGB confidently reported that nothing in the Western arsenals could smash through the hundreds of feet of rock which in both places separated the Politburo from the surface. This fact was of little comfort to Admiral Yuri Ilyich Padorin. He found himself seated at the far end of a 10-meter-long conference table, looking at the grim faces of the 10 Politburo members, the inner circle that alone made the strategic decisions affecting the fate of his country. None of them were officers. Those in uniform reported to these men. Up the table to his left was Admiral Sergei Gorshkov, who had disassociated himself from this affair with consummate skill, even producing a letter in which he had opposed Ramius's appointment to command the Red October. Padorin, as chief of the main political administration, had successfully blocked Ramius's transfer, pointing out that Gorshkov's candidate for command was occasionally late in paying his party dues
and did not speak up at the regular meetings often enough for an officer of his rank. The truth was that Gorshkov's candidate was not so proficient an officer as Ramius, whom Gorshkov had wanted for his own operations staff, a post that Ramius had successfully evaded for years. Party General Secretary and President of the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics, Andrei Narmonov, shifted his gaze to Podorin. His face gave nothing away. It never did, unless he wished it to, which was rare enough. Narmonov had succeeded Andropov when the latter had suffered a heart attack. There were rumors about that, but in the Soviet Union there are always rumors. Not since the days of Leventry Beria had the security chieftain come so close to power, and senior party officials had allowed themselves to forget that. It would not be forgotten again. Bringing the KGB to heel had taken a year, a necessary measure to secure the privileges of the party elite from the supposed reforms of the Andropov clique. Narmonov was the apparatchik par excellence. He had first gained prominence as a factory manager, an engineer with a reputation for fulfilling his quota early, a man who produced results. He had risen steadily by using his own talents and those of others, rewarding those he had to, ignoring those he could. His position as General Secretary of the Communist Party was not entirely secure. It was still early in his stewardship of the party, and he depended on a loose coalition of colleagues, not friends. These men did not make friends. His succession to this chair had resulted more from ties within the party's structure than from personal ability, and his position would depend on consensus rule for years, until such time as his will could dictate policy. Narmonov's dark eyes, Podorin could see, were red from tobacco smoke. The ventilation system down here had never worked properly. The general secretary squinted at Podorin from the other end of the table as he decided what to say. What would please the members of this cabal, these 10 old, passionless men? "Comrade Admiral," he began coldly, "we have heard from Comrade Gorshkov what the chances are of finding and destroying this rebellious submarine before it can complete its unimaginable crime. We are not pleased. Nor are we pleased with the fantastic error in judgment that gave command of our most valuable ship to this slug. What I want to know from you, comrade, is what happened to the Zampali aboard, and what security measures were taken by your office to prevent this infamy from taking place." There was no fear in Narmanov's voice, but Podorin knew it had to be there. This fantastic error could ultimately be laid at the chairman's feet by members who wanted another in that chair, unless he were able somehow to separate himself from it. If this meant Podorin's skin, that was the admiral's problem. Narmonov had had men flayed before. Podorin had prepared himself for this over several days. He was a man who had lived through months of intensive combat operations, and had several boats sunk from under him. If his body was softer now, his mind was not. Whatever his fate might be, Podorin was determined to meet it with dignity. "If they remember me as a fool," he thought, "it will be as a courageous fool." He had little left to live for in any case. "Comrade General Secretary," he began, "the political officer aboard Red October was Captain Ivan Yuryevich Putin, a stalwart and faithful party member. I cannot imagine—" "Comrade Podorin," Defense Minister Ustinov interrupted, "we presume that you also could not imagine the unbelievable treachery of this Ramius. You now expect us to trust your judgment on this man also?" "The most disturbing thing of all," added Mikhail Alexandrov, the party theoretician who had replaced the dead Mikhail Suslov, and who was even more determined than the departed ideologue to be Simon Pure on party doctrine, "is how tolerant the main political administration has been towards this renegade. It is amazing, particularly in view of his obvious efforts to construct his own personality cult throughout the submarine service, even in the political arm, it would seem. Your criminal willingness to overlook this obvious aberration from party policy, does not make your judgment appear very sound." "Comrades,"
You are correct in judging that I erred badly in approving Romeus for command, and also that we allowed him to select most of Red October's senior officers. At the same time, we chose some years